this connection between me and Voldemort? What if the reason for it is that I am becoming more like him? I just feel so angry all the time. And what if after everything that I've been through, something's gone wrong inside me? What if I'm becoming bad?
I want you to listen to me very carefully, Harry. You're not a bad person. You're a very good person who bad things have happened to. You understand? Besides, the world isn't split into good people and Death Eaters. We've all got both light and dark inside of us. What matters is the part we choose to act on. That's who we really are.
Welcome to the Anglophiles Podcast, a podcast where two Americans talk about British TV and movies. I'm Sheldon.
I'm Danny.
And I have been sitting on the most exciting TV news, and I cannot believe you didn't see this show. It's like, I've been hiding it for like a week and a half, and I'm so jazzed.
Oh, okay.
Like, I know we're supposed to ask about each other's lives, but this is all I can think about okay. Right now. So, if you don't know, Netflix announced that in the last year, we want to make more TV shows and movies in the UK. And so they opened like a whole office and they announced 7 upcoming TV shows with some like pretty big names. People like Joe Cornish and Sam Mendes are directing things, which is exciting stuff that's like sci-fi and horror. There's like
Is Snow Crash one of them?
I believe that might be one of them. But the one I want to talk about is called Man vs. Bee. Have you heard of this?
No.
Okay. So, a man finds himself at war with a bee while house-sitting a luxurious mansion. Who will win, and what irreparable damage will be done in the process? Starring Rowan Atkinson.
Oh, okay. All right. I was like, this is probably going... With how ridiculous that premise is, I knew that it was going to have an all-star actor.
But, like, can you imagine just a show, like... It's Rowan Atkinson and a bee. Like, that's the whole show. I think from what I read, it's 10 minute episodes.
Wow.
So they're just quick physical comedy with Rowan Atkinson.
I love it.
Yeah.
Wow. That is great news.
I'm so excited. That is ridiculous. So everyone look out for Man vs. Bee. I think it's coming sometime next year. I don't know the date yet.
Well, that's incredible news. I can't believe I didn't hear about that.
Right.
Yeah, well, it is Christmas time. We are Ooh. 4 days away from Christmas, which means I think we're going to post this 2 days before Christmas.
Yeah,
we actually could.
On Christmas Day.
We actually could release it on Christmas Day. I think that's what we're going to do. We just came to the decision.
We will be releasing
right
this on Christmas Day.
On the podcast.
You are listening to this on Christmas.
Hey, everyone, Merry Christmas. Or if you're in England, Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
As apparently they say in England.
I would love to know how and why that changed. Like, so if you have any knowledge of that subject and you're a listener out there and know why the Brits call it Happy Christmas and why we say Merry Christmas, I'd love to know.
Yeah.
I like linguistics and I like to see why words change. That would be really interesting.
It's very strange.
I mean, speaking of strange, this has been a strange holiday season. I think for everyone, it's been a strange year. And I you've heard that phrase so many times from every company that's like, oh, this has been a tough year. But like, these holidays have been pretty tough.
Yeah.
Like, it's a time where you don't usually stay at home by yourself.
Yeah. You're usually with family, but because of COVID.
You're not.
Yeah, we're not traveling. This is very weird. I have never not... seen my family at Christmas or seen your family at Christmas because once we got married we started alternating, but
yeah, I've lived in Los Angeles for 10 years now and I've never spent Christmas in LA. This is my first time.
Yeah, we're gonna have our own little Christmas with our cats.
Yeah,
it'll be great.
We're gonna chat with our both of our parents. We're gonna video chat and I think play some board games via Zoom and stuff.
Yeah,
it's gonna be, we're making new traditions this year. Everyone's making it work.
Should be fun. Well, we actually have some messages from our listeners.
We have the greatest listeners, by the way. We don't talk about it enough.
We really do.
But, like, those of you who, like, interact with us on social or have reviewed us, like, our podcast in the App Store, thank you so much for interacting. We love that you also share our love of British TV shows and movies.
Yes. So this message is from Nick Williams, who wrote in. He messaged us on Facebook. He said, "Hey, hope you're both doing well. Thought I'd drop you a line on Bob Mortimer. Just listening to the podcast."
God, I love him.
Yeah, we love Bob Mortimer. He says, "He's a genuine national treasure and has been in the national consciousness since 1990 when he starred alongside Vic Reeves in Vic Reeves' Big Night Out. The show was unique and exposed a generation to the avant-garde, daft in the extreme type of comedy. More recently, Bob and the much-loved Paul Whitehouse of the Harry Enfield Show have recorded a couple of series of Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing, which came about following some serious health episodes for both men. Wow. It's a, to use a very British term, smashing show with Paul, with Bob and Paul fishing in some of the most beautiful locations in the British Isles, and is at times, quote, emotional." I actually would love to listen or to watch that.
I mean, honestly, that sounds delightful.
Also, if you want to get to know Bob a little better, he has appeared on Richard Herring's Leicester? I don't know how to pronounce. L-E-I-C-E-S-T-E-R.
I think it's Leicester.
Leicester Square. Theater podcast at least once. Ooh. You've got an incredible source of material to go at, and it's always a pleasure to hear a new episode. Cheers!
Thank you. Yeah, that's some great Bob Mortimer stuff to dig
into. There's some really cool content suggestions there. So thank you, Nick.
And I'm glad that he is as much of a national treasure over there as, like, he holds a place in our hearts.
that's actually what I replied to him with. I was like, I'm so glad to know he's as treasured there as he is in our house.
Incredible.
He's just delightful. Makes you happy.
Like, I would die happy if I could get one of those little toys or inventions he makes. Like, every time that he was...
Like, the little elephant with the sausage that twirls.
Yes, all the stuff that he brought on Taskmaster, Would I Lie to You?
Bob.
Like, he invents everything.
I love him.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, that was a message from Nick. We also had a very recent message from Paul Stevenson, who's written in before.
Right.
Quick little message.
It was an update on something we had said in a podcast.
Well, our last episode, the Pirates Band of Misfits.
Yes.
I had you try to guess what the meaning of the red ensign was.
Yes.
And I said it was the British flag. And then we were like, what does that mean? Like, I've never heard it called that. According to Paul, the red ensign is the British naval flag.
Yep.
So it is a red flag. It's an all red flag. And then up in the corner is the Union Jack.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So there are various different versions of the flag.
We don't ever see them.
Yeah. Because, I mean, we're American, but also we're New World. So it's one of those things that flags aren't used the way they used to be. It's just weird.
True. And then we have a package.
Oh, my
one
goodness.
Of our listeners asked for a shipping address for us to send us something. So we replied, and one of our listeners, Jeremy Bundy Cook, has sent us something.
Like the greatest care package.
Truly,
it's so sweet.
Truly, truly awesome.
Dive in and describe. So first off, these are tea towels.
He sent us two tea towels, which is something we don't really have in America, but like...
Now we do.
I bought a tea towel when I was a tourist in London. And I never hung it up, but it's really cool. But Jeremy has sent us two tea towels. One is a Kit Kat tea towel. So it's big and red, and
it has the
Nestle Kit Kat logo on it.
And the other one is a cat brand we don't have here in the U.S.
Cat food.
Cat food, Felix. And it says, "Cats like Felix." And it's got this cute little, like,
cat. There's a cute cat on it.
He's great. He's also sent us... a quite an assortment of treats. We got the Walker Prawn cocktail chips.
Yep.
He has.
We actually, I think we tried these in our last episode.
Yeah, we did.
It was so funny when he sent us his package and I opened it and took out the prawn cocktail chips. It was so funny because, yeah, I think it was the day after we had recorded and tried these. So thank you for these. I love them. So I will devour these.
He also got us Kit Kats that have different flavors. Now, this is something Kit Kat's famous for around the world. There are different flavors of Kit Kat. In America, it's a big bummer that they don't really branch out much. In Japan, there are like dozens and dozens of flavors. But he has sent us three of the Nestle Kit Kat flavors from England.
I think
are,
there's more than three?
No, he sent us six total, but there are three flavors.
Gotcha. Orange.
Cookies and cream and dark mint.
Dark mint.
Oh, no, there is fork. Here just dark.
Dark chocolate Kit Kat. Dark mint, cookies and cream, and orange. We are going to have to try these on a later episode.
He also sent us a candy bar called Topic. That did we figure out what this was? It's a hazelnut, milk chocolate and hazelnuts with nougat.
Nougat?
I don't know why I said it like that.
Nougat?
Oh, I hate myself a little bit. And then there was...
the fries chocolate cream.
Yes.
It looks so good. It's like, it looks like a, it says rich dark chocolate with a smooth fondant center.
And see, like growing up, a cream drop for me was always like a Christmas specialty. Ooh. Like my mom would only get them for us like in Christmas time. We would have little like cream drops. So that I think I'm going to love. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for sending me, like we've been showing restraint and haven't opened any of those candies. I did, however, open the lemon mints, the Peppersmith lemon mints. These are phenomenal. I love them.
Yeah, you love lemon.
I love lemon, and I like both the like tart lemon as well as the sweet lemon. And this is kind of like somewhere in between, and it's really enjoyable. I really like these mints. They're neat.
There is also a British Kit Kat in here.
Oh yes.
Yeah. So I know we tried one recently, but it was a big. It was like one of those giant.
Yeah, it wasn't the right shape.
Yeah, so now we have just a plain Nestle Kit Kat. So we will probably try that on an upcoming episode. Jeremy also sent, we were missing...
Missing a couple of coins.
So when I went to London, I collected the coins because I wanted to be able to make that the coat of arms.
Yeah.
Where you can put all the coins together and it looks really cool.
Because it's so unique that like...
It is so cool. And
no
like,
other coins have that.
We're Anglophiles,
ability.
So you know, that's very thrilling and novel to us here in America. I realized, even though I went to London a couple years ago, I realized I was missing, I think it was the twopence. So I mentioned it on our Facebook and so Jeremy sent us one. So now
amazing.
We can actually make the coat of arms.
Yeah.
He's also sent a couple of other coins as well.
This is going to be some violent ASMR, and I apologize.
There is a 5 shilling coin.
Nice. Yeah, he had sent us in some that are quite old, that are a couple that are before the Elizabethan era, right? Yeah, there are a couple of like modern ones that are that I think I distinctly remember seeing George on.
Interesting.
Oh,
I was thinking Elizabeth I.
You know,
when you said that.
As I say it, it's like I've said on this podcast before. I don't understand eras. My brain like blocks that out, and so when somebody says like Victorian, I'm like, yeah, I know. I know what it looks like. Like, if you had to put me on the spot and tell me any of the years involved, I would be terrified.
Gotcha. But yeah, there's a 5 shilling. There is a... What is this one?
See, yeah, there's some...
That's a half of a crown.
Oh.
Half crown. There's a 3 pence. There's a farthing. 2 pence. Yeah, this is really cool. We now have a nice little collection of English coins.
Yeah, which is so cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, again, yeah. Jeremy, thank you so much. This is amazing and...
Yes, thank you. Yeah. We are going to be posting pictures of all of these on our Facebook page.
Yeah, so check
maybe
that out.
Instagram as well. So yeah, we're Anglophiles, files with an F.
And talking about all of this money that's a little like strange to Americans reminds me of our topic today. Because it also features money that's strange to Americans.
We are finally covering Harry Potter.
Just the movies.
Just the movies. I mean, we'll end up talking about the books.
I'm sure. We wanted to really focus on this movie franchise as a whole and devote, like, we figure maybe later down the line, we'll do another episode just for the books. Because it's just a topic that's so dense and so pervasive into culture at this point. Mm-hmm. This could be an 8-hour podcast. We don't know. We're starting right now earlier.
This is going to be a long podcast. Yeah. So if you're here, thank you. Get a snack.
Yeah, stay a while.
This is so Harry Potter, it's interesting. I think this was a good choice. We've kind of been putting this one off. I think that I thought I would have to do a lot of research and prep a bunch of information and we'd have to rewatch the movies. And I think we just kind of ended up saying, why don't we just rewatch the movies?
Yeah, and I mean,
in time for Christmas and then cover it.
Because that, for two reasons. One, for a lot of Americans who had ABC Family, they play Harry Potter nonstop in the Christmas
time.
They
do Harry Potter the marathons.
Especially the first two movies nonstop. Yeah. They don't play the darker movies as much. And now I know ABC Family doesn't exist anymore.
That makes sense. The first two are lighter.
I think there was a period of time where it was kind of synonymous with Christmas. And I think in...
Well, and the movies also released in theaters at Christmas. So,
yeah, but that's what I mean. I think it's like entrenched in our head, so it felt right for right now. Mm-hmm. But then also, like, we have such knowledge of these. Like, we've grown up with them. I don't think it took a lot of research into this because I possess a ton
of
knowledge of
this. You're a huge fan. Like, I am a pretty...
My first tattoo.
Pretty big... Oh, yeah. I consider myself to be a pretty big Harry Potter fan. But you, to me, are even beyond that because I remember I read the books as they came out. I think I read them all once and then I saw all the movies as they came out. I collected the merchandise. I saw the movies again and again and again. I've been to Wizarding World. But you are one of the people I know who actually has read the books multiple times.
Yeah, I would. There was a period in my life where I would read them, the franchise, every year.
Mm.
I would just start from the beginning and read it again.
It takes time.
It does. But I really loved it.
Seven books?
It mattered so much to me. I remember whenever I graduated high school, our family went on a trip. My parents wanted to kind of celebrate, and so we went on a little trip. And I remember going to the airport, and we were... Like, they had just put out the books, but it was at 4 a.m.
Which book?
The final one. Deathly Hallows.
Oh, okay.
So, like, I see the very final book is there, but it's behind the, like, kind of gate. And the woman is, like, putting them up. And I know, like, my flight
the store was closed?
Yeah. My flight is going to leave before I can get the books. So I slipped her... I think, like, the books weren't that expensive at that time. I slipped her, like, 20 or 30 bucks. And then she just passed the book under the store. And, like, no receipt or anything. But, like, that woman saved my life. That she must have known. I think she gets it with that franchise. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, you need this.
I do remember there being kids who... I was not one of them. I think I came at them at a very, like, average pace. But I do remember there were kids who, like... When the final couple books came out, like, they would not leave their room. They would just read, and their parents would, like, bring them food.
I wasn't far removed from that. Like, my mom knew from Goblet of Fire on, we did midnight releases.
Mm.
Like, so I did the midnight release twice in Missouri, once in New Jersey, and then this final one wasn't midnight, but it was in the airport.
Mm.
And for each of those, I read them that weekend. When it got released, it was finished within 3 days.
Wow. That's pretty quick.
I loved it.
I remember.
And the movies, I mean, we just powered through. We just watched all eight movies in less than a week.
We watched all of them. It was really fun.
It was a lot of fun.
I remember I had heard of them, but my mom read them first. My mom started the first one and then the second one, and she was like, you really got to read these.
Yeah.
Diane, if you're listening... I think it's really cool that you read them before I did.
Yeah.
She was so excited to read them. And she started the first one. She started the second one. And she was like, you got to read these. So by the time she was on the fourth one, and the fourth one had just come out, that's when I started the first one.
Oh, wow.
So I read the first one, second one, third one, fourth one. And then, we waited for the rest to come out.
Gotcha.
But it was so exciting. And I also feel like... For a young American, the Harry Potter movies were a really good introduction to English culture.
Yeah,
I think so. It's true that a lot of the culture in the Harry Potter books is pertains to the magical world, but they use like English slang words. There are British foods.
Yeah, and I think before Harry Potter, our last kind of, for our generation growing up, the biggest thing before Harry Potter was the Spice Girls, who are kind of caricatures of British culture in every way that, like, I don't think, as much as they are treasures, I don't think people would say that's a good representation of what England is, are these five women. But I think seeing this, you're like, oh, I get to see a lot of London. Like, well, it's very different.
I definitely, as a kid, years before the Harry Potter books came out, was reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So that was kind of my first, like,
gotcha,
this is English. Well, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, but we also, like, watched a lot of things like Mary Poppins and stuff like that. So, sure. But, yeah, I think Harry Potter got, like, an entire generation vaguely familiar with English culture.
And it got a generation reading, which is crazy.
True.
We had stopped.
There were kids that weren't reading full chapter books who then started because of Harry Potter. Yeah. So, that's really interesting.
We said we weren't going to talk about the books, and that's all we've done.
I think it's impossible not to talk about them.
Right, but let's talk about it as a movie franchise. Okay. So this is a franchise of 8 movies that started in 2001 and ended in 2011.
Mm-hmm. That's a long era.
Yeah, 11 years, and like for 8 movies to only have like a couple years in there with breaks, to like honestly watching children grow up in front of our eyes. That, other than the like the Richard Linklater stuff, you don't see that done anywhere. Like,
yeah,
this was such a like a success in filmmaking of picking incredible, talented, like gifted youth and surrounding them with talented adult actors and good cinematographers and good directors and writers who are able to like handle children. And the fact that it worked, that we have 8 great films out of it, that, like, I think in most franchises you go, oh, skip that one. That one's bad.
Right.
But, like, you don't in this.
I think, for the most part, yeah, the Harry Potter fandom is very pleased with the movies.
Yeah. I mean, and sure, like, everybody can nitpick, and there's something that is your favorite thing that they're probably missing in the movies.
Peeves.
Everyone, like, yeah. Like, I'm sure there's something that you're out there like, but they didn't have this. Yeah, we get it. They missed everything. Of course it would be better as, like, an HBO miniseries. Like, yes. But what we got is great.
I think, yeah. I think they turned out really well. And I do think it's incredible that, you know, they were casting kids. They were trying to get kids that looked cute and were talented.
Yeah.
But to get the trio of Dan and Rupert and Emma, and for them all to, like, turn out to be, you know, pretty great.
Yeah. And, I mean, obviously, it's impossible to tell from a child to go, like, are you going to turn out to be somebody who is, like, can you carry the weight of what we're giving you?
Mm-hmm.
Because the franchise also turned from like a children's story to something dark. So it's like, can these children handle that? We have no idea. We're casting them for a children's story. Like, it was cast before the final books were finished.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Like, everything involved in this, like, it's amazing that it all worked out.
And that's really interesting to me, knowing, like, when we were doing this rewatch and we watched 1 and 2 and then we started to get through them, seeing like how much screen time Seamus had in the first one versus later, he's barely in them.
Yeah.
And then seeing as how, like, they cast someone to play Lavender Brown, didn't have any lines in the first one, and then they recast her later because Lavender Brown suddenly becomes important. It is very interesting to see how they dealt with how much they put into casting some of the kids that didn't end up being important.
Yeah. Well, and I think you had found a great article. I don't know if we need to go deeply into it, of just showing how they adapted in the movies characters who were better or more or less underrepresented and overrepresented than they were in the books. And it just, I think it goes to show that they had a very specific vision in mind.
Mm-hmm.
It was not straying too far from the source material.
Yeah.
But I think they very much knew what they wanted to accomplish, and they wanted Hagrid to be a huge part of it.
Yeah.
I think Hagrid is a much different character than he is in the books, but it really, really works that he is, like, other than the children, he is the adult you look to when you're in this world, where you're like, Dumbledore is way too smart for us to understand. He's always doing some, like, magic nonsense. But, like, Hagrid seems as lost as we are.
Yeah.
And so, like, you think of, like, the trio and Hagrid, mm-hmm. and it's, like, their story.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, it's very emotional at the end whenever the trio has kind of left Hogwarts. And when you finally see him again and he's, like, captured, ugh.
Yeah.
It hurts.
Yeah.
It's incredible growing with these movies and growing with the actors.
Yeah.
Every one of them. I mean, from, we talked about the trio, but then, like, the side characters, like you were saying, the fact that they all kept coming back, they didn't have to recast a lot of them, that this is a project people wanted to be in on.
And what is truly amazing about watching these is because, you know, you and I started watching these when we were, like, what, 13 years old?
When
the first movie came out, I think I was around 13. And then watching them now and then starting to realize how many incredibly famous English actors are in these movies.
Oh, geez. All right.
Like, it's like almost every professor is like a celebrated BAFTA-winning...
Incredibly famous, yeah.
actor.
I actually started putting together a list because this was... Like, everyone talks about how wide-reaching it is. Like, everyone's in Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And they are. Like, it is such a deep franchise. And I think now we do that with Game of Thrones for the next decade. Mm. We'll say that. But I went through all of the episodes of our podcast, and I checked and saw the ones that featured somebody who ended up in the Harry Potter franchise.
Wow.
It's almost exactly 50% of the things we've covered so far mm-hmm. feature somebody who is in the Harry Potter universe. Or it gets even better when you think about somebody like Stephen Fry,
yeah.
who voices the audiobook,
mm-hmm.
who is in like a bit of Fry and Laurie, and then he was in QI.
Yeah.
And then somebody like Nicholas Holt voices Harry Potter and Robot Chicken. Peter Dinklage played a goblin, technically, but it's, like, not official. I don't
know.
There's so many people that are around this franchise.
Yeah.
And some people that I think we've shown a lot of love on our podcast. There are, let's count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 that I know of. Actors who are in the Harry Potter universe who have appeared on at least 2 of our podcasts.
Whoa.
Can you name the Harry Potter actor we've talked about the most in 4 different appearances on our podcast? There's several that have 2 appearances and then 3 that have 3, but one actor we've done 4 different podcasts about.
I feel like John Cleese has shown up.
John Cleese has 3 different appearances on our podcast, so he is in the top.
Is Donald Gleason...
He only has 2 appearances, but he's also on
the
list.
Are you sure? Because he was in About Time. Mm-hmm. He was in Black Mirror. He's in Harry Potter.
But see, I'm not including Harry Potter on this list.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying he has 2 appearances before this episode comes out. And his dad has 3 appearances on the list.
Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah. Mm. Who is in Secret of Kells, 28 Days Later, and Pirates Band of Misfits, which we just did. Honestly, Pirates is what pushes a couple people over the edge.
Is it Russell Tovey?
No. He is not on my list, but I think he is in 2 movies we've
covered.
Wait,
Russell Tovey's not in Harry Potter. Never mind.
No, yeah, also, duh. But, it's David Tennant.
Oh, of course. That makes sense. Doctor Who.
Doctor Who, Broadchurch, Good Omens, and then now Pirates Band of Misfits. Who also features, this was surprising to me, the woman that has appeared in the most podcasts of ours from the Harry Potter universe is not Emma Thompson like you thought. It's Imelda Staunton.
Yeah.
Who is in...
she was on Pirates, Band of Misfits.
She was also in Downton Abbey and in the Paddington movies.
She was a bit of Fry and Laurie. Wait, Imelda Staunton is in Paddington?
She's the aunt.
What aunt?
I forget her name. It's her and... who plays the uncle is her husband.
Oh, she's the aunt, Bear?
Aunt Bear, yeah.
Oh, that's Imelda Staunton. She's the aunt. I was thinking of a human...
No.
I thought...
Aunt Bear.
I was thinking of a human aunt.
It's her, and then I forget the uncle's another big guy.
Is it Michael Gambon?
Yes. And so, yeah, there are two Harry Potter people
and
there.
And Julie Walters is in Paddington.
Yeah, Paddington has a bunch. But, I mean, Game of Thrones has the most Harry Potter people.
That makes sense.
It's got Jim Broadbent, Michelle Fairley, Natalie Tenna, David Bradley, Kieran Hines, Freddie Stroma, who is Cormac McLaggen.
I always forget.
Julian Glover, like everybody.
Is that... There. Kieran Hines is in Harry Potter.
Yeah, and then he shows up as Aberforth and, like, honestly gives more gravitas to that role than is maybe deserved. Mm. But, yeah, love that.
Wow, interesting.
But, yeah, just that's how far-reaching and how many incredible, talented people are in this.
Yeah.
And that's not even, like, touching the directors. Like, I mean... Starting with, like, it's insane that this movie started as a Spielberg movie, the very first one. A lot of people, I don't think, know that.
Mm.
That Steven Spielberg spent the first 5 months of this movie making it. Like, he spent 5 months making it, and he finally, like, he had reservations the whole time about doing a children's movie. He didn't want to get back into that and didn't think that, like, he kind of thought his career was past that, and honestly, it is. And I think he just kind of decided... Somebody else needs to helm this. Like, I'll let somebody take over from where I am. And then... Chris Columbus came in and directed two, like, perfectly fine family movies. I think they're great. Like...
Yeah, the first two... So, I know that as someone who was so into the books, when I saw the first movie in theaters, everything looked exactly like I pictured it in the book. There were maybe a couple of weird things that I had never envisioned. But
it's like Diagon Alley looked perfect.
Yeah.
When you see the castle for the first time from the boats, you get chills.
Yeah. Harry looked great. Ron looked great. Like, they all were perfect. I think
Hagrid is huge.
The thing that threw me off the most seeing that movie in theaters for the very first time was when I read the Harry Potter books and when they were in class a lot.
Yeah.
They were in classrooms. A lot of that book... And I remember picturing American-style classrooms.
Oh,
just because that was my only reference for what a classroom looked like.
So you were thinking of, like, linoleum and, like, fluorescent lights
and, like, a computer lab. Yeah, I was picturing an American classroom. And so when they were in their Hogwarts classes, especially the one, like, the charms class with Professor Flitwick, when that's the famous Wingardium Leviosa scene.
Sure.
They're in these kind of, like, stadium-style seating. And I was like, what? I remember that being the only thing to me that wasn't
that,
how
that was
I,
confusing.
It was the only thing I hadn't pictured that way. So, I think the first movie really did a fantastic job.
Yeah. The first movie really, like, knocked it out of the park, I think, in every level. Like, giving us a troll and, like, Quidditch. They nailed, like, how flying looks, which is such a hard thing. Like, they easily could have messed that up, but it looks real, real good.
I know a lot of fans before that first movie came out. Before the first trailers came out, I knew a lot of fans who were, that was the thing that they were curious to watch the most. Like, they were curious to see how it was going to be done in a movie.
Yeah.
Was the Quidditch.
I was obsessed with Quidditch.
Yeah.
I hate the rules. I think they're wrong and awful and they don't work at all, but I love the idea of the sport.
Yeah.
And he kind of really nailed that. And then in the second movie, you know, you bring in Kenneth Branagh, who,
so good.
Great choice. Originally was supposed to be Hugh Grant, which we've talked about. That would have, like, nailed a couple more members
of Hugh Grant would have been a very good Gilderoy Lockhart.
Yeah, I think he had to back out because he was filming something else, and Kenneth Branagh ended up probably being a better choice. Like,
he was wonderful.
I think Kenneth Branagh can play full of himself very well, and he does a great job, but I think that movie showcased the need for a more advanced director.
Mm.
I think seeing kind of that the book started to get more dark, and they realized, like, Christopher Columbus is killing the children's fun aspect of this.
Yes.
But it's about to get very serious in tone, and so they had to make a big shift.
Mm. Yeah.
And then they go to Alfonso Cuarón, who is now an Academy Award winner. And I will highly expect him to win again and again. Like, one of the most talented directors. I love him.
When the third movie came out, do you remember being a little shocked, but super excited at the changes that were made to the way that Hogwarts looked?
Yeah.
Because in the first movie, it looks fine. Like, everything looks great. But in the third movie... There's that giant, like the giant clock.
The clock shows up. It's the first time.
The grounds
time.
Are also changed. Like there mm-hmm. are like levels and stairs outside. Yeah, it's outside. Not one building. It's not like a lawn. You know, it's not like a Downton Abbey lawn that the castle's on.
It's also the first time where you see people wearing normal clothes outside of their robes.
That's true.
For the first two movies, they're always wearing robes. Mm-hmm. For this one, it's a little more casual, which is a good intro.
I think it was the way to go.
It's smart.
They're teens. You don't want to see the teens wearing their school uniforms
right
all day every day.
He also introduced us to the choir. Apparently Hogwarts has a choir where they sing songs with frogs. Maybe the only misstep of the whole movie. Like,
you don't like it?
The song's a banger, but the implications of a choir that practices and has to keep frogs just for singing,
yeah.
I don't want to think too much about that. I think that there's a lot that I love that he did. That I don't want to delve into.
Do you
into.
Know what that song is that they're singing?
The Double Double Toil and Trouble? Yeah, that's Macbeth, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
Yep.
I think another thing that this movie does that's very important is this is the first movie where we get Michael Gambon as Dumbledore. Oh. That, like, before that, in the first two movies, we have the incredible Richard Harris, who... You and I differ on this, but I think that is much, much closer to the Dumbledore that I had always pictured in my mind. Was a very soft-spoken, slow-moving, like, thinks-before-he-speaks kind of a guy.
Mm.
Michael Gambon gives us somebody who demands your presence, which is a different Dumbledore, and I'm here for it.
You know how I feel about the Dumbledores.
Yeah, you were bored by the first one.
No, Richard Harris... Phenomenal actor. I think he was a great casting choice for Dumbledore at the time. But for me, Michael Gambon...
he's so perfect.
He's so good in this role.
Yeah.
And I also think, to me, maybe he's not exactly the Dumbledore that I pictured from the books. But he is a little closer. I picture Dumbledore being very agile. Not looking like an old man, but not speaking or moving like an old man.
Yeah.
And Michael Gambon...
He does nail that. I'll give him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's...
For sure.
Great. They were both great. They were both great Dumbledores.
That movie also gave us the introduction to Dementors, like what they look like. Oh, they're... And those kind of change what they look like as the movies go on. Yeah. And later ones look a little different. This movie also gives us Lupin and a werewolf that looks different than other werewolves in movies. I really appreciate the weird, skinny, kind of sickly-looking design.
So people talk about this all the time, that this werewolf in the third movie... was one of the most interesting depictions because it was lycanthropy, but as an actual illness.
Yeah.
Rather than, oh, I'm not turning into the most muscular beast that's really good at fighting. Like, he's sick.
Yeah.
And I've never seen anything as scary in my life as when I saw that werewolf for the first time with how long his arms were.
Yeah, and the way it, like, howls at them.
The way he walked.
It really feels like a beast, and not in the way that we're like, when we watch Underworld or whenever you read, like, you play Skyrim and can transform, you're like, oh, cool, yeah, it's a wolf with arms, whatever. This, like, it felt wrong.
Yeah.
And it worked.
That's
like
a really good point.
Oh.
The cutest thing about that werewolf, though, that I noticed on this rewatch that I've never seen before... is that if you look closely, he's got Lupin's hairstyle. He still has a little bit of hair on his head that's combed over.
Oh, I didn't notice
that. It's really
cute.
And it is also a little bit of a signifier of, like, there's still a man in there. But yeah, I think that the third movie was really kind of a turning point for the franchise because the third book was also one of the best books.
Yeah. It's the only book to not have a Voldemort story or a Voldemort as the villain. So it feels different and it's like time travel. So, like, it's unique in so many ways.
When I read, when it was revealed that Scabbers the Rat was actually Peter Pettigrew.
Oh my God, yeah.
And that we had believed him to be an actual rat for three entire books. And he was introduced in the first book as having been missing a finger or missing a toe.
Yeah.
It changed my awareness of what you could do with writing.
Yeah.
That you really can create surprises, like the long game, you know? Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was really great. But yeah, third book is so good. And I think if the movie hadn't been good, it would have sucked.
And then I think they took a big risk in the director for the fourth.
Who did the fourth one?
Mike Newell. Who is...
Is this his only one?
Yes. I mean, he's well-renowned. He did Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Okay.
He did Donnie Brasco. Like, great. He has done some good things. He has also done some very bad movies.
Like what?
Like Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's a very talented director. Casting him for this was not a smart choice.
Well, that's just one of the things, is that when you're casting a director or when you're getting a director for a film, you can direct a great movie, but it doesn't mean you can direct a... incredibly large budget franchise film.
Yeah,
you know,
and we saw like Edgar Wright got kicked off of the Marvel franchise for not doing Ant-Man the way Disney wanted, where you have to play the studio game. And I think Warner Brothers realized with this one, the Mike Newell thing didn't work out. Goblet of Fire is kind of a very messy movie in a lot of ways.
It was the first movie as they started coming out that I was disappointed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't to say that the movie is bad, because we watched it. It's great.
But I think it's everyone's...
It was the first movie that significantly left out things from the book that I really...
It had to. That this book and the next three are so dense.
It's true. Yeah, the fourth one was much bigger than the third one.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
It's just enormous. But visually, a lot of the tasks didn't look exciting. Like, I mean, there's stuff to love in the fourth movie, but just the way that he's handling it and the way everyone's hair and costumes look. When Voldemort comes back, they nail, like, wow, Ralph Fiennes, yeah. Yes.
He looks great.
But the weird Ku Klux Klan hoods that they're wearing.
Oh, the Death Eaters?
The Death Eater design, I hate how they come back. I don't like it.
Yeah.
And I think Warner Brothers was like, okay, we see the end game for what this franchise is.
Yeah.
This was a misstep. We can't have this happen again at the end and fumble the ending.
Yeah.
And they found a team player and got David Yates, who directed the next four.
Amazing. And the next four are all great movies.
I think it's because they're very cohesive. He knew immediately how he wanted to do it. He already had kind of a blueprint in front of him of like, all right, these are the past four movies. I know where we've been.
Yeah.
I know what they like and what they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just went crazy with like the... He really latched in on, I think, the emotion that was missing in the third and the fourth. Mm. That the fifth one is very emotional.
Yeah.
And that doesn't go away. He just finds different ways to tell you that this is a tragic story. Like, yeah, it's a tale about Harry defeating evil.
Yeah, because the fifth one starts off with them and the Thestrals, right? Like, yeah. That's how they get to school.
Yep.
And it's just a reminder that, like, Harry survived a traumatic experience. He has seen death.
And, by the way, no one believes you. Like, not even your best friend is on your side right now.
Yeah. Fifth one was great. You know, I think it's my favorite of this rewatch that we just did. I really enjoyed the sixth one a lot. But fifth one is where they introduce Luna.
Yeah, and they nailed that. I mean, this is the first fan that was cast into the franchise.
Yeah, like, she was like a huge Harry Potter fan, and she made her own like Luna Radish earrings.
And those are the ones she wears in the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, that is, she is perfect.
That was a really, really good casting.
Yeah, they nailed that. And I think that movie is one where it is better than the book. That may be the only movie that you can be like, it's way better than the book.
The fifth book was the very first book that I ever put down and took a break from.
Yeah.
Every other Harry Potter book I started and then read within like a week. The fifth one was the very first one that I started it, didn't really know what to make of it, put it down for a couple weeks, and then had to come back to it.
It's a book where it's just like, everybody are like sassy little bitches that can't communicate with each other, and if they would only like talk to each other, no one would die.
Yeah.
It's all of their faults. It's not your fault. Harry beats himself up for it. It's everyone's fault.
Yeah.
That's Luna and Neville. Luna and Neville were like the champions of that book, and then both of them also like ended up, bad things happened to them because of it.
Ugh. Yeah. But I think for that book being as weird as it is, I think that movie turned out so good.
It crushed it, and then he revamped the design, like the Death Eaters look new and different. Mm-hmm. He made changes, like we were talking about, Alfonso Cuarón made changes where he just added the way that wizards can disapparate and apparate into these like black and white clouds, which is visually striking. Doesn't make sense in the context of magic, but
I
like
love it.
It looks so beautiful. You don't care. Yeah. And I think that's the stuff that David Yates did where he's like, I'm going to change enough to where you get that this is impractical, but it looks good enough to, it improves
it's
the world.
It's one of those things that, yeah, it wasn't in the book, but it's one of those great visual, signifiers, you know, like you could have people just appear on the screen, but it does look really cool when they appear in like a puff of smoke. So
yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
And then such an emotional death where Sirius, who is just becoming very close to Harry, and then Harry has to deal with that now. And then that gets into, like you were saying, the sixth movie might be my favorite. I mean, it's got a lull in it, but for the most part I really love it. We haven't talked about him yet, but Alan Rickman is giving such a performance in that movie from start to finish. I mean, in the whole franchise, he has a very tumultuous role. Mm-hmm. He's got one that it's controversial what people think of Snape, but Alan Rickman was incredible in the whole franchise.
Oh, absolutely.
But more than anything, in this movie is very, very good. Mm. And watching his scenes with Michael Gambon, knowing the end, like, he's so impactful in such a small amount of time.
He's,
I think,
so talented.
There are other people who are in this franchise that you can tell, like, they need a lot of time to be in a scene to build up to something, where Snape can just walk in, and with a flourish of his arm, you're like, yep, I'm focused on only you. Like, you're...
It is true. When Alan Rickman's on screen, you're not really looking at anyone else.
And he has a way... I love the way the camera will push in on him when he's staring. He'll just be staring at anything, and the camera's like, gotta zoom in on this. Like, you want to see those eyes.
It's one of those things where, like, when I was reading the books, the first couple before the first movie came out, Snape was such a terrible character. You hated Snape. You were scared of Snape. He was so mean and so terrible. And then they cast Alan Rickman, and how can you not love Snape?
Yeah. But I mean, he still does the perfect things where he like hits Harry and Ron in the back of the head with books, and he's still like deducting points and like trying to kill them and stuff. So
yeah,
like,
he's not a villain, but he is, you know, an antagonist.
And I think he does such a good job that, like, whenever you finally get to him in the eighth movie, seeing him, like, in control of the school and being one of Voldemort's right-hand mans, but learning it was all just to sacrifice Harry, what a...
Yep.
What an awful life Snape has lived.
It's Ooh. True.
Because then, true. Yeah, I mean, all right, so the sixth movie... You have Harry,
Half-Blood Prince.
Harry and Dumbledore are finally getting close. Dumbledore's trusting him again. Yeah. Oh, we didn't even talk about it. The end of the fifth movie is the first and like the best fight in the entire franchise. Dumbledore versus Voldemort.
Well, to me, once the movie goes from them being at school to the kids, the group of kids
in the ministry,
going to the Ministry of Magic.
Yeah,
that's
the movie.
Moment until the end of the movie is probably my favorite stretch in any Harry Potter movie.
No, I can't argue
that.
Because
the kids are doing such a good job. And it's what they're doing is incredible, but it's also shot really well. And the Ministry of Magic whole set piece is gorgeous.
Yeah, from everything.
It's beautiful.
With the room with all the orbs and the prophecies.
Yeah.
The way they fight in there. And then the room with the veil.
Yeah.
And how when the good guys finally show up.
Yeah.
And then you have the final fight. That, like, one-on-one.
When Dumbledore and Voldemort.
It's evil Vegemite.
When they duel in the Ministry of Magic, it's my favorite duel in the Harry Potter series. Because the things that Dumbledore is doing are incredible. It's interesting. A lot of them are defensive. Because the things that Voldemort is doing are horrifying.
Yeah.
Like, breaking all the glass and then turning it into like making it come at them like projectiles, and then Dumbledore turns it into like harmless sand. Like it's
it represents who they are and their kind of their outlook on the world. That Voldemort is very much, I will take what I want.
Mm-hmm.
The things that I need them and I will get them.
Mm-hmm.
And Dumbledore has always been, we must protect that which is important to us.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, like, his sister wrecked him, losing her. But so, like, every spell he's doing, like you're saying, is protective. Even the most violent spell Dumbledore does is, like, he's trying to drown Voldemort within a ball of water. But that doesn't do any damage to anything else.
Yeah.
It's a ball of water hovering in the air. Like, so even at its core, he's not harming things.
That's true. That's like, that's a good point, because Voldemort really is, like, wrecking the Ministry of Magic. I also love that moment where Voldemort, like, I don't even know how to describe it. He takes a fireball out of his mouth and, like, and then breathes it.
So that's the fiend fire that you asked about. So at the end, when it burns down the Room of Requirement, that's the same thing, but Goyle just didn't know how to cast it. He's bad. Something else I noticed this time watching the Voldemort-Dumbledore fight. There's no score.
Yeah. And
in every modern day fight thing, like Pirates of the Caribbean, in The Avengers, in Fast and the Furious, in Star Wars, every finale showdown has this, like, almost at this point, obnoxious John Williams, like, you gotta have a duel of the fates. You gotta have something that'll either, like, jazz you up or make you cry.
Yeah.
And this, it's like, no, we're just gonna let magic happen and let you decide for yourself who is gonna come out on top.
I don't think I even noticed that. And I just know that I'm transfixed.
Yeah. I think it's a very good decision. Like, ugh, wow. Beautiful.
Yeah. I love the fifth one.
It's great. It's phenomenal. The sixth one, yeah, and then, like we talked about, Harry is building up, getting closer and closer with Dumbledore. It culminates in them going into the cave and finally finding a first Horcrux, coming back, and Dumbledore dies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Snape kills him.
That was such a big deal in the book. Like, I remember kids all over America were crying.
Well, people were getting spoiled.
When Dumbledore died.
Like, did anybody do that in your school? I felt bad for people who hadn't finished it.
No, because I didn't really know people that were reading it.
Whoa, see, like, it was such a big deal. I guess I'm 2 years behind you. Maybe you were, like, you were a cool kid at that
point. I wasn't. The kids at my school probably thought they were too cool to read Harry Potter.
I'm thinking you had already graduated high school by the time the sixth one came out, maybe.
The book?
Yeah. I don't know. We don't need to get too into this. But the sixth movie has a lot of really good moments, too. Like, Dumbledore dying is so sad. And then, like, I can't shake the memory of everyone lifting their wands in the air and lighting up the Dark Mark with, like, bright light. Like, such a beautiful moment.
Yeah, that was a really big moment in the franchise, because now people associate the raising of a wand with...
with, like, respect.
The passing, yeah. Like, when Alan Rickman passed away.
Yeah.
That was a really big thing.
Yeah, and, it just immediately became entrenched in the fandom. And I think...
the sixth one was also the moment that I think everyone really understood how great Daniel Radcliffe was.
Yeah.
Because he had done a really good job with this role all through the franchise. But... he gets some very good comedic moments in the sixth one, and it was this movie, I think, that a lot of us were like, oh, shit.
Yeah, and I think he...
Dan Radcliffe.
He has talked publicly about really not having a good time filming the fourth and fifth ones, and he, even as, like, a teenager, was really struggling with alcohol use, and filming most of the fifth movie, he was drunk filming most of the movie. And so I think... the sixth one, I don't know what happened in between. There are a lot of interviews you can read. He's pretty secretive about it, but he found the joy again. Like, he got the excitement for it, and I think part of it is the director really pulled it back out of him.
Yeah.
And you can tell he's having fun.
Yeah.
And the scene, I think everyone's thinking about it, like, with the pincers.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and his whole scene when he is on the Liquid Luck is also a scene with Jim Broadbent. And Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah.
So it's like...
like, two, like, incredible
that
talents.
That scene was just going to be amazing.
I mean, adding in Jim Broadbent late into a franchise for a character who, like, is pretty beloved in the story. He is somebody who is kind of a slime ball, but you love him.
Yeah.
Like, he redeems himself at the end, and perfect casting. It's like every time they have to introduce somebody, yep, you nailed the casting. Like, Gary Oldman is Sirius Black. Sure, absolutely. That's who you need. Yeah. Like, oh,
Jim Broadbent
so good.
Is a treasure.
And then we get to the seventh movie.
Mm-hmm.
Deathly Hallows Part 1.
Mm-hmm. Pretty dark.
Pretty dark. Pretty bleak.
I've seen the last two Harry Potter movies multiple times. Saw them in theaters. I've seen them multiple times. I do get the events of these two movies mixed up.
The last one ends when Ron comes back and kills the Horcrux.
Mm.
And, like, the trio is returned again. They're, like, down a Horcrux, but realizing, like, okay, we know what we need to do. Like, we've done it. No, that one ends because that's, like, the start of Act 3. And then it goes to Malfoy Manor.
Interesting.
And then, you know who saves the day? Our boy that we haven't seen since movie 2. Dobby's back.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Oh, we saw him in the fifth one, maybe. But Dobby's back. He saves the day. He protects us from Bellatrix Lestrange, who is, like, one of the most evil people in the world. Even though she can do magic, she carves on Hermione's arm with a knife. Like, evil woman.
A slur.
Like, the worst slur.
She's,
like,
terrible.
Man, again, nailed the casting.
Like, yeah, I mean, who doesn't love the character of Bellatrix Lestrange because of Helena Bonham Carter?
And the same way with all the Malfoys. All three of the Malfoys are so impeccably cast.
Oh my God, like, Helen McCrory, who has probably been in a lot of the stuff we've covered.
You'd be surprised.
Helen McCrory, because she was in Doctor Who. She was in Peaky Blinders. Yeah. Not that we've covered.
We haven't done Peaky Blinders.
We haven't covered Peaky Blinders.
That's the thing. She's
but
in a lot we haven't
Helen McCrory
done.
Is like kind of a female Gary Oldman in that she just disappears into the role. She always looks different, no matter who she's playing.
But she is pulling off that, like, white streak kind of a thing. I don't know what you call it. Love the look. Also, same with Jason Isaacs. Like, I feel like he is so perfect to play a bad guy.
Love Jason Isaacs.
And it's one of those things, like, I'm sure every Brit who's listening to this is picturing him in a much different role. But every American our age and a little bit older see him as the villain in
The Patriot. Yep. Like,
and so it's incredible the things that we put these people in and how they're able to just disappear into this.
Yeah.
And so, like, we've been culminating. It's leading up. It all gets to the final movie, the eighth one. Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows Part 2. Showdown at Hogwarts. Harry and Voldemort finally fight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Finally get defeated. And then it's over.
Yeah.
It's one of those where, like, the final two movies are great, but it's just, you're immediately left with a sense of, like, yes.
I think the ending, I think that they did a very good job with the ending.
Yeah.
I think they did a really good job of building up how evil Voldemort is.
Yeah.
And
the fact that he would attack a school.
Yeah, just a reminder that all he wants, it's like the reminder of the stakes, you know? Yeah. If he wins, the Wizarding World is in big trouble.
If he wins, the Wizarding World falls.
Yeah. They do a very good job.
Nobody other than the trio knows about the Horcruxes or knows that he even has them.
Yeah.
And so these are the only three people in the whole world who can keep the most evil wizard from being immortal.
Yeah.
Like, that's insane to think about. And then to have this big weird bit of morality talk in the middle where, so there's a thing that as it was happening, you asked me a question because I think it confuses a lot of people. Harry dies. Harry Potter literally dies in this movie. But he doesn't.
Yeah.
Because Voldemort, the first time he tried to kill him, because he had split and fractured his soul so many times, the act of love was enough to break that final bit of his soul,
mm-hmm.
where love is stronger than, like, tiny fractured pieces.
Yeah.
And so the spell rebounded, and what was left of Voldemort, that tiny bit, smushed into Harry. And so whenever Voldemort kills him in the woods, like Dumbledore tells Snape, it has to be Voldemort to do it.
Yeah.
Because only Voldemort can kill that part of himself.
Mm.
And so Harry is meeting with Dumbledore, kind of it's a really interesting situation where he has that moment where he asks him, like, is this in my head or is this real? And Dumbledore, like, it's just plainly like...
Classic Dumbledore. He's like, of course it's happening in your head. Doesn't mean it's not real.
And Harry gets to ask him, like, am I dead? What happens now?
Yeah.
And Dumbledore looks around, like, explaining to him, like, this is all of your making. You're, like, essentially in a coma right now.
Yeah.
If you want this to be the end, if you want this to be the sacrifice you made for the world, I'm sure you can do that. You can summon a train and peacefully exit knowing that, like, your fight is over. You have fought a lot.
Yeah.
You have done more than anybody else has. We're cool if that's what you want to do. And Harry's like, nope, got to get back into it. I got to finish what I started.
One thing that really struck me watching it this time, I think watching something when you're younger versus, you know, years later, stuff can really hit you once you've gone through different life experiences. And one thing that really struck me this time is I think Harry Potter, like in the wizarding world, there are so many great heroic characters who do amazing things. And Harry Potter is not, I wouldn't say he's at the top of the list. It's his story, it's his franchise, but Harry Potter is kind of along for the ride.
Yeah.
He is an active protagonist, but he's not necessarily doing these amazing things. He's kind of a hothead.
Yeah.
He will, you know, he runs on emotion. He gets mad at stuff for good reason, but still. But to me, the fact that he just willingly went off to face Voldemort knowing, oh, I'm probably going to die right now.
Yeah, with no accepting it.
Yeah, that to me was the last final heroic gesture I think you need from the character.
And, well, I think it's dropping the stone in the forest, where he takes the Resurrection Stone, turns it, his parents show up, Lupin shows up, and Sirius does. And they talk to him. And he's like, does it hurt? And they're like, no, it's quick, it's easy, like, it's fine. And then he's like, I want you guys to be with me. And they're like, we are with you, we're right here. And, like, point to his heart, and that kind of lets him know that, like, I'm passing, and I'm still with people.
Yeah.
Like, the thing that he is most worried about is, like, he's gonna be gone for everyone else's life he's in.
Yeah.
And knowing that, like, they can be okay with it, yeah. I think that's a big moment. And I think... I had a different one this time. Like you were saying, there's so much that hits different that, you know, when you read the books as a kid, my favorite line that I really wanted to see in the movies was Molly Weasley saying, not my daughter, you bitch, and killing Bellatrix. Like, classic. Perfect. They nailed how it looked. Like, I loved it. But there's something that, like, made me cry this time, which was whenever, like, I think when you're older, you realize the stakes for the adults, for the professors who have been through this once and are now like, this is a child that was taught at our school coming to destroy our school.
Yeah.
And so whenever McGonagall does the spell that gets all of the stone statues to life, like stone pieces of armor she has seen every day for decades and decades, like when she was a professor and when she was a student, and to ask them to protect Hogwarts. And when she says, like, I've always wanted to use that spell. It's a moment where you've, like, you're like, you know she never wanted to use it.
Yeah.
But this is a situation where it's, like, a little levity. Where she's like, we might die, but I've always wanted to do that. Like, and I think that really got me. Where I was like, all these wizards know they're probably dead. Yeah. Like, the fact that they don't die is literally fate. Harry stops fate from happening.
Well,
like,
some of them do die.
Yeah, and a lot of them do. A lot do.
I can't believe Lupin and Tonks died.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, and they don't touch on it really, but months after they just had a baby.
Yeah.
It's rough. Their relationship in the movies is upsetting how gone it is.
Yeah.
But man, I mean, we've recapped all these movies. I feel like I need a bit of a break to, like, replenish.
Yeah.
Like, maybe some snacks and maybe, like, some food and some drink.
Yeah. It's time for a snack break. And I think it's time for snacks from the Wizarding World.
Magical.
Okay, welcome to Snack Break. This is the part of the podcast where we take a break from our subject and try a British food.
Yes.
And review it. So for this episode, we decided why not do some treats from the Wizarding World of Harry Potter?
Yeah, and we could have obviously done the official licensed treats that I think a lot of people have tried, and we've tried them in the past, so we thought there's no need to try terrible flavored beans or, you know, like, I think we've done a lot of the stuff. We've gone to Harry Potter Land and have tried the snacks there. So
yeah,
this is our own little...
We've had pumpkin pasties. We've had cauldron cakes. We've had jelly slugs. We've had Birdie
chocolate
Bots.
Chocolate frogs.
Birdie Bots every...
What are the flies?
Fizzing Whizbees.
Fizzing Whizbees. That's the good shit.
One of my favorite candies that you can buy today that are from the Wizarding universe.
Highly recommend. They're like, if you have Pop Rocks inside of chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
If that sounds good to you and you go to the Wizarding World, get Fizzing Whizbees. A chocolate frog is just chocolate. That's boring. Get Fizzing Whizbees. Much better.
So good. There's a lot. There was a lot to choose from. And then I was like, well, maybe we'll cook something. But yeah, I don't know. I didn't know what to do. So I decided that we are going to have butterbeer.
Yeah, so you've made butterbeer for us, specialty for us tonight.
We also have a plate of mince pies.
Yeah.
Which I think we've had, I think we've tried them on here before.
I think so.
But
they feel like Christmas.
Yeah, this is a traditional English Christmas food. And they are visible in a couple of Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
The sixth one for sure.
Ron has a bunch of snacks. Ron likes to snack.
Yeah, well, I also like to snack. So we're gonna try butterbeer.
Bottoms up.
I also want to just point out there were 1,000 butterbeer recipes.
I'm sure
online because there were recipes from before the movies came out. They're just from the books. There were recipes from once Wizarding World started to sell cold butterbeer and frozen butterbeer.
Yeah,
people trying to copy it.
And then there are hot versions.
Yeah, like there were. I didn't really know what to do, but I read this recipe. It seemed simple. It seemed delicious.
All right. So what's in it?
So this is vanilla cream soda.
Okay.
Butterscotch schnapps.
Okay. I like those two things.
A little bit of Cool Whip on the top.
Yeah.
And a drizzling of butterscotch syrup.
Okay.
On the top. So it should have a nice vanilla, buttery butterscotch flavor. Let's try it.
Mmm. Well, that is very good.
Mmm. It does look like...
It looks like beer.
It does look like a mug of beer.
Yeah. I mean, the whipped cream stays in the way that, like... You know how in commercials, foam sits at the top of beer, like, longer than it does in real life? Like, mm-hmm. It goes away quick in real life. But in this, like, the whipped cream is staying at the top like foam.
Yeah. I remember reading about the butterbeer in the books, and I imagined it tasting like actual butter, like, really buttery.
Yeah. And not butterscotch.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking that way either.
Yeah. Because,
like, I didn't like butterscotch growing up. My dad was a dentist, so I wasn't allowed to have it, really.
Love butterscotch.
Too sticky. It ruins your teeth.
It is buttery and good.
All right, let's try one of these little mince pies and see how well they go with it.
Cool.
Let's imagine we're Harry and Ron.
They're so small.
We've just bought the entire cart. Nobody else on Hogwarts Express is going to have any. Just us.
We'll take the lot.
Oh, why don't Americans do tiny pies? Seriously, this is like, it's such a good food invention. Make a tiny little pastry, but like, give it that pie crust. Like, I want this over Little Debbie or Hostess any day. There's too much cake and not enough texture. This is like so firm and delicious. Oh.
These are really good. I already very much like mince pies because you're getting a lot of crust. So if the crust is good, it's really good. And I really like the filling. I like the fruit and everything that's in it. It's sweet, but it's not too sweet. And it's also a very nice portion pie. You know, it's not like a giant slice of pie. So I'm a fan of mince pies. These are, in particular, they're Walkers, are known for their shortbread.
So it's like a shortbread pie?
I don't know that they use their shortbread recipe for the crust for these, but whatever they use is delicious.
I appreciate the drizzling of the sugar on top.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes granulated sugar does not go well with pastry, and it feels weird, the texture, but this...
Walker's mince pies. Oh. Yeah, they're so good. This
it's
is a,
so good.
Such a good English treat that I wish was more prominent in the U.S.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I think, like... Americans have a weird misconception about what pie is and what it can be.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's so weird how Americans don't understand meat pie as a concept. Like, they're like, but that meat doesn't go in pie. That's where fruits go.
Yeah.
And you're like, can you, you can't imagine
A chicken pot pie is probably the closest thing.
We're a company or a country that breads and deep fries everything. And you can't imagine baking meat into a pie. A chicken pot pie. You're right. We already do it. Ugh.
Yeah. It's very strange. That one of my favorite things about visiting England, going to London, was getting meat pies. They were so good. So good. Have you ever been to Greg's?
I didn't get a chance to go to Greg's whenever I was there. But I did see somebody posted online the other day a Photoshop picture of leggings with the Greg's logo all over them and called them Greggings.
Wow.
I thought that was pretty clever.
Interesting. Fascinating.
This was good. I think this butterbeer is very good. I think I would recommend to people out there to do what you did, and you cut it with a little club soda to cut keep it from being too sugary and too sweet.
Yeah, cream soda is... I love cream soda, and I really loved it as a kid, but it is so very sweet. So, yeah someone suggested putting a little club soda in
If you want to drink the whole thing, I recommend it.
It does make it less of an amber color. It looks...
looks like a light beer.
A little paler, but it's delicious. I think...
very good.
I think that the cream soda, butterscotch schnapps, club soda, whipped cream and butterscotch terping? I'm drunk.
Just off that little bit of schnapps. What are some foods or drinks in the Harry Potter universe that you would have liked to try? Is there anything that's mentioned that you didn't get a chance to try?
So, cauldron cakes to me always sounded really good. I didn't know what they were, but they always sounded so good. You can get a cauldron cake at Wizarding World. It's... I don't think it's very good.
It's cake in a mold.
And
you have to scoop it out.
Too much frosting.
That was one of the most disappointing things from there.
I didn't like that.
Highly recommend skip that if you go.
But what else? What else is in the Wizarding World?
I always wanted to try fire whiskey, which I imagine now is like cinnamon whiskey, which I really enjoy.
That's like kind Fireball? Of what.
Yeah, I imagine Fireball is fire whiskey. I kind of just put them together. There was...
Honestly, some of the most exciting Wizarding World foods to me are ones that I have had because of having gone to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter in Los Angeles. But pumpkin juice and pumpkin pasties.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to try both of those.
I wanted those, and I've now had them both.
I also wanted to try the one that, I mean, it's literally impossible for them to make, so I get why they haven't made it, but... the canary creams. Fred and George make... apparently they're like custard cream cookies. But when you eat them, you turn into a giant canary.
Wow.
And I always love that. It's so fun. Wow, this was delicious. This was a very good break. And I think much needed before we head back in.
Let's get back to it. Okay, so I know we've already touched on this a little bit, but do you have a favorite movie in this franchise?
If I just want to pick one out of a hat and watch, I'll put on the third one. I think it's the best standalone.
The third one is a great choice.
But my favorite is the sixth one. I love that movie in the context of the franchise, but I think the third is the best movie.
The third has a great plot to go off of, so it's already good, and then it was executed extremely well.
And it's so rewatchable, because I think you kind of forget about the time travel until, like, it starts happening, and Dumbledore, like, is like, well, off you go, and then you're like, that's right, they're about to go do the things.
Yes. Yeah, third one is a really
it's so
good.
Fun.
I know, I think the third one is probably a lot of people's favorite book and movie. So I think that's a great choice. You know me, the fifth one is my favorite.
You love it.
But the sixth one...
growing on you.
I'm really starting to appreciate the sixth one a lot. Yeah, it's quite good.
What about then, keeping in line with favorites, who's your favorite character in the movies? Because you already mentioned your favorite character that didn't make the movies was Peeves. Who's a great poltergeist.
I wanted him to be in it.
Ones that are in here.
Favorite characters. There are so many good characters.
Yeah.
Molly Weasley.
Oh.
I adore.
Yeah.
She's the mother you want, you know? I mean, I love my own mother. Diane, if you're listening, love you. But Molly Weasley just is like, for Harry not knowing his mom, for having lost his mom as a baby and her kind of becoming like a second mom, wonderful. It's what he needed. So Molly Weasley, especially played by Julie Walters, is great. McGonagall, gotta love her.
I was gonna bring up McGonagall. I think she crushes it. Love her in every scene.
She's a phenomenal character.
I love that she was literally fighting breast cancer when she was filming the last movie.
I didn't know that.
Maggie Smith is such a force.
The character is already so great. She's a badass. She's smart. You want to listen to her. You want to follow her.
Yeah, but she elevates it.
She's wonderful.
I mean, I think I mentioned, I really like the way Jim Broadbent plays Slughorn. I think that's electric. It's so much fun. He's
so good.
Him transforming as a chair cracks me up every time. Like, Merlin's beard. He's so fun.
Luna is another favorite of mine.
So great. Every scene she's in, she manages to be both incredibly genuine and naive. And, like, that's a combination, I think, that's hard to strike. But, like, Ivana Lynch really does a good job with that character.
She's good.
I mean, the whole trio, I love the main three. And in different movies, I think different ones of them are pulling more weight and doing a great job. I think Emma Thompson never gets any credit for Trelawney. And she's doing some really funny work.
She's wonderful.
I mean, I can't go this far and say that Hagrid's not my favorite. Because of course he is. Like, I mean, of course. He's got to be.
He's great.
He has to be. I mean, who else? Who are we missing?
I love Tonks and Lupin.
Okay, I've got a new one. Okay. Who's your favorite character that only appeared in one movie? Mine's Oliver Wood. I guess he shows up in the final one. He shows up in the battle.
Oliver?
And he does the waving his hand and it's over the Quidditch pitch.
Oh, yeah. Oliver was one of those characters who, like, when the first movie came out, I was about the same age as Dan Radcliffe and Rupert Grint, so...
I remember being so mad I didn't get a call.
He wanted to be Harry Potter.
Because I thought...
Yes, you wore glasses and you
had
black
hair. And I
had
messy hair. They always described it as messy hair, and so whenever they cast a boy with straight, perfectly fine hair, I was like, I don't buy it, but he does a good job.
He's good. Oliver Wood was one that I, like, as a little 13-year-old was like, oh, he's cute. Like, Oliver Wood is cute. And, like, watching it now, I'm like, he's fine. He's whatever.
Yeah. But, he was great.
Interesting.
I really love Gary Oldman as Sirius. I really love David Thewlis as Lupin.
Lupin. Okay, so this brings me to my other question for you. You have your favorite characters.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite character romantically? Like, what character do you have a crush on or you know you would marry if you lived in the Wizarding World?
So, there are not a lot of options for ladies, really.
What do you mean?
Like, if you stop and think about it.
Oh, because you don't want to name a teenage girl right now.
Well, I mean, that, but also... There are not a lot of options for ladies in the Harry Potter universe. Mm. Like, it's very much a male-centric world. Luna and I would have fun. Hermione and I would have fun. Neither would last. I'll say that.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
But I think, I don't know, somebody who plays Quidditch.
Angelina?
I mean... Angelina, would you go to a ball with me? Yeah. Yes, I would.
I
do love that moment. Him just being like, I'm going to go with Angelina. Have you asked her yet? And then just turning and asking her. Like, the confidence of an older Weasley brother.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's amazing to just see, like, how one of them becomes, like, this dragon tamer. And then, like, another one is, like, fights a werewolf. And then you have those twins who are inventing, like, the most awful, like, beautiful, incredible things. And then there's Percy and Ron. Like, you're like, what happened, boys?
Percy went into bureaucracy.
And no Wan. Everybody needs a Samwise.
When I read the books, I had a crush on Fred and George. But then with the movies, and now that I'm older too, I am so in love with Lupin.
Yeah.
I love him.
I get it.
I think he is, just watching his scenes with Harry, he's so supportive and very, like, generous in his, like, hey, I know everything sucks, but, you know, here's some happy things. Like, he takes very good care of Harry in the 1 year that he teaches him. I think he's heroic. I think he's noble. Yeah. I love Lupin.
Yeah, I really like him.
He's good.
I think also another wizard who kind of takes on that, did not like the casting initially because I hated the character design compared to what I thought in my mind. But I really love the way Brendan Gleeson plays Mad-Eye Moody.
Oh my gosh, he's so good.
Because I think you can also tell, knowing what we know now, that it's David Tennant the first time playing him. Or, like, he is Barty Crouch Jr. as him. Yeah. Like, he's playing two different characters in the fourth movie and then, like, the sixth movie. Or the seventh when he shows up again.
Yeah.
Like, it's very interesting to see how different, like, Brendan Gleeson can do it.
Yeah.
And then he even becomes, like, his own kind of fatherly figure to Harry in a strange way.
Yeah. He's great.
What are some moments you like from, like, not just characters, but what is a moment that sticks out at you? Like, to me, I really super love whenever they open Weasley's Wizarding Wheezes. And you get to see the whole joke shop. Everything in that scene, I'm so happy for them. But then Ron asks, like, how much is this for me? And they're like, 5 galleons. And it's like, well, I'm your brother. 10 galleons. Like,
yeah.
It's just such a brother moment that I really love and appreciate. Even in a very serious movie, they found time to be like, we need to give a little of this.
Yeah.
Like, I really love that moment.
I love that. I like when Ron is, like, having his nightmare about the spiders tap dancing, and Harry's just like, you tell those spiders, Ron. That's a great moment. I think all the students facing the Boggart is
yes.
a really good scene when, like, all of their fears are coming to life.
I mean, Alan Rickman in that hat. Like, so, what a shot.
And the fact that, like, they all have, like, giant spiders and things as their Boggart. And then, like, poor Neville is just so scared of Snape. So,
oh, God.
Yeah, that's great.
I think my all-time favorite, though, is when Harry realizes that he's the one that casts the Patronus that saves himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's able to do it, like, it's such an empowering moment, and it's, like, beautiful on screen. But it is such a moment where it's like, oh, I have to do this.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, well, I've already done it, so I can do it. Like, there's no thinking the whole time. He's really struggling with, like, how do I do this thing that's impossible?
Yeah.
And just, like, it's in you. You've got it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they really
What do you think
that.
Are some of the big moments for fans?
Because
I feel like Hermione punching Draco.
That's a huge one.
It's huge.
I mean, it's weird because with this too, like, the fandom is so big and sprawling that, like, some people like parts of this more than others. Like, I know for me, a moment that I love in the horrible fourth movie, at the very end, whenever Harry brings back Cedric's body, the guy who's playing Amos Diggory, the dad, crushes it with the line where he's like, that's my son, that's my boy. Like, it's haunting. Like, I can't unsee that scene. Like, I hear it all the time. And so, like, that's something, like, do I look forward to as a fan? No, but, like, it's a moment that sticks with you. Like, there are a couple of moments that, like that just hit hard.
I always love the moment when they destroy, I think it's the Diadem Horcrux, and Voldemort just feels like he feels it, and then you just get that shot of, like, Ralph Fiennes as Voldemort, like, for the first time looking worried,
because
the whole time he's come
it's
back
like, I got this.
He's like, eh, I'm not scared of anything, and in that moment he's like, ugh. And that's just incredible acting.
I also love, like, all of the acting in the scene in the fifth one where they're fighting and Sirius just says to, like, he's back-to-back with Harry.
Dueling
Death Eaters. Like, something that he probably dreamed of. Like, he was in Azkaban for decades. Like, didn't get to see his friends. The last memories he has is of doing this, fighting evil with his best friends. And then he's doing it with his, like, best friend's son and says, like, nice one, James. And that's the last thing he ever says. And I think that is so fitting of who he is. That, like, he would literally give his whole life multiple times to the Potters.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's probably one of the best moments in the whole franchise. Like, I mean, the finale is great. Harry fighting Voldemort is fine. He defeats him. Great. He turns into those pieces of paper that float off.
Yeah.
Neville cutting the head off a snake. I mean, yeah. They're great moments, but, like, the moments, I think, remind you of the bigger story.
Yeah, that's true. What is your favorite magical creature?
Pygmy punk. Pygmy puff. I always do that. A hinky punk and a pygmy puff. They get them confused. I love pygmy puffs. They're dumb and small.
I knew that you loved pygmy puffs. I didn't know that it was your favorite.
I don't know. I mean, it's a thing where, like, that I see in the movies. The design of the Thestral is great. It's gross enough without being too gruesome.
Yeah.
I really like that design. I mean, the hippogriffs look cool. I like them.
It's true. Yeah, they look good. I like the monster book.
Yeah, the monster book. And the fact that they actually built that, like, that's mechanical. I like that that's practical. I like how much in these movies is practical. That's something that I don't think enough people talk about, that, like, in Chamber of Secrets, they had a giant snake head that was part of it. Like, that they were doing blocking. Like, yeah, it was CG that they added. But, yeah. Like, so much of these movies is practical. Shooting on location. Like, the fact that they got to shot in these colleges and, like, the restricted section where the library is, yeah, is a very, like, I don't remember the name of it, but it's an extremely famous college and they don't even let fire inside. And so the fact that they did a restricted section shoot shows, like, how much care went into making all of this, where they're like, we need this shot, yeah, from this best library in the world.
Yeah.
And they were able to say, like, yeah, you're the first person in hundreds of years to take a flame in here.
Yeah.
Daniel Radcliffe. Like, I think that's the kind of thing that people are trying to replicate the success of this franchise again and again with other young adult movies.
Yeah.
And nobody takes the care that they're taking with this. And that's why it works.
Yeah.
Like, because they spend time and effort and money, like, acquiring stuff that forms the groundwork that the actors can play in.
Yeah. That's that's true. If you could own any item from the Wizarding World, what would it be?
I mean, I want to say a wand, but that's a cop-out. Because if I was a wizard, I would have a wand. So, done. I want a broom.
You want to fly?
But, like, I'm scared of heights, so not one of the good brooms. Like, I want one of the shitty ones that they talk about. Like, a clean sweep 7 seems like the exact level of speed that I want.
Gotcha.
I don't need to play professional Quidditch.
Yeah.
I just want to be, like, 3 feet off the ground. So if I fell, I would just get that didn't feel good.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to hurt myself. Like, but I want to fly. It'll be fun.
Interesting. That's a good
idea. What about you?
I mean, I want to say a wand too, but, like, you're right that we would have wands. It's just, that's one of the greatest things you can own as a Harry Potter fan, is some kind of wand.
Yeah.
I think a time turner would be great.
The implications of the time turner. I'm really glad that she got rid of it because.
Yeah. The invisibility cloak is also great. If you've ever had social anxiety, I feel like an invisibility cloak would be such a good way to be able to walk around and observe things and go places without having to feel observed.
Yeah.
So.
But, like, you would have to have the invisibility cloak. Like, the only one. Because, like, all other ones just didn't work right. Or aren't. You can kind of see them shimmering, or they don't last forever.
Mm.
Like, the Peveril Brothers one is the only one that works.
Interesting.
Yeah. Oh, that's another favorite moment. Like, the animation for the Three Brothers story is incredible. I need a whole story told in that animation.
It's so really fun. Cool.
Bringing up wands reminds me, like, do you want to know some fun facts behind the scenes for this?
Yeah.
So there are a bunch of, like, quote unquote facts, things that you're like, well, Harry, Daniel Radcliffe went through like 80 different wands filming this because he would always like break them. He drummed them like drumsticks and would like hit them on his legs. He went through like 160 pairs of glasses. Wow. Just because he was growing up and they had to keep getting different glasses for him.
Yeah.
But like, those aren't the fun facts I want to get into. So one fun thing. In the very first movie, Harry Potter doesn't cast a single spell. You were talking about just how much everyone else around him does
more. He doesn't do Wingardium Leviosa?
Nope. He is in the room when it's done. He does not cast a single spell in that whole first movie.
And that's what's so interesting is that at the beginning, he is such a passive protagonist.
Yeah.
That he literally is there to observe.
Yeah.
That's really funny.
I love that. I mean, speaking of the beginning, going back way earlier in the movies, like one of the first things you see are owls that show up bringing Harry letters.
Yeah.
So two things. One, they actually trained owls to drop letters off. Two, they hand wrote every single one of those, like Harry Potter cupboard under the stairs, whinging, like, they wrote all of those, like, multiple times so that they could keep doing it. There were, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds that, like, actual owls were, like, dropping into chimneys. That, it seems crazy and weird to go through that level.
Yeah.
But, like, there's stuff that comes up, so many stories of set that, like, we talked about they switched from the first two directors to Alfonso Cuarón. And you know this story, but when Alfonso Cuarón took over, he wanted to bond with the children. He didn't do a lot of children's stuff, and his stuff is a bit more adult, like his movies. So he wanted to connect with them and give them some actors' homework. And he said, I want you guys to write a small little essay. Write me a paper about who your character is.
Can I guess what happened?
I've
heard about this once. Rupert Grint didn't do it.
Yeah, so Rupert forgets.
Yeah.
Dan Radcliffe wrote, like, a paragraph of who he thought it was, and...
And then Emma Watson...
It was, like, a multi-page thing. Yeah.
They, like, did exactly what their characters would have done.
And Alfonso Cuarón was like, I can't be mad. Like, I cannot be mad. That's what happened. A lot of people complain that Harry Potter's eyes are supposed to be green.
Yes.
It's very big deal in the book.
Yeah, he has his mom's eyes.
He was allergic to the contacts they kept trying to wear. And, like, it got to the point where they're like, nope, we cannot legally put contacts in him. Like, we will hurt this child.
I didn't know that.
But somebody who did not have a problem, and somebody most people probably don't realize, Alan Rickman's wearing color contacts the whole time to make himself have, like, black pupils.
Yeah.
Because he has a much lighter colored eye.
Interesting.
And it's to make him look more evil.
Ooh,
and he didn't have a problem with it. So much so that, like, David Yates, when he showed up, he, like, mentioned it. He was like, oh, your eyes look different. And Alan Rickman just, like, popped one out in front of him. And was like, yeah, they just, like, put him in like this.
Wow.
There's so much that... people who are going to be in this were, like, destined to be in this. I think, like, the actor who plays Draco Malfoy, Tom Felton, auditioned first for Harry.
Yes, I've heard that.
Because, like, he was somebody who, out of, like, all the kids, has the most experience.
Yeah.
He auditioned first for Harry, and they liked him. They knew they were going to cast him, but he wasn't Harry. Then they made him audition for Ron. Even worse of a fit. And then he got Draco, where it's finally like, yep, this is it. We found it for you. He's a great Draco. And one of, I think, the best lines in the entire franchise, he improvised on the day because he couldn't remember the line. It's where they're taking Polyjuice Potion and he goes, I didn't know you knew how to read. That was an improv. Yeah.
Wow. That's one of the fun, that was like one of the first really funny moments in the franchise for me.
Yeah. And speaking of Tom Felton and Alan Rickman, both of them would steal things constantly. Like, apparently Tom Felton was very obvious about it, and they started sewing his costume pockets shut.
Because
he would stuff things in the pockets. Wow. But apparently Alan Rickman at the end, like, he stole his wand, several things from the potions room, and a couple things from, like, his house set. Like, at the end, Alan Rickman was loving how much he was getting away with.
Amazing.
Oh my God, there's so much that I want to go through where it's like, Dolores' Umbridge, her clothing gets darker and darker as it goes by. Like, it's always pink, but it goes from being pale pink to, like, this, like, hot pink the darker
that
she gets.
She's
like,
so evil.
She's so evil. And, like, there's just, there's so many facts that I want to, like, none of them matter, but they all matter, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
To me, there's so much funny stuff where, like I said, people who are destined to be it were there, where Eddie Redmayne was originally going to be, like, young Tom Riddle in Chamber of Secrets.
Oh, interesting.
Like, he was pretty far in the audition process, but didn't get cast. I think it's just such a beautiful, strange thing that happened, and I don't understand how all of this came together.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
eight very good movies.
One thing that that I remember reading was at one point I went to school for special effects makeup, and I remember starting to do a lot of research even before I went to school about special effects makeup and how the crew for the Harry Potter franchise, they reused a lot of the same crew. So they were using the same effects people for all eight movies. And so this was like all of the people like in costumes and scenery and in all of these things, they had this job for 11 years,
wow.
Which is kind of unheard of that you would work on the same franchise for that long.
You never get those jobs.
And like once I realized that, I really started to think about like how special the franchise is.
Yeah. Like you're saying, not just for the actors, but for everyone involved. Like, this was a huge portion of their life.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I remember when we were watching the last movie yesterday, just looking at Daniel Radcliffe, just completely nailing the ending scenes. And just being like, he's so famous for this one thing. He is as famous in our world, I think, as Harry Potter is in the Wizarding world. And the fact that now he doesn't need any money, so now he's just doing really fun roles and can do whatever he wants now, is just a really beautiful thing. And I think it's really cool that the person that they cast as Harry Potter ended up taking it as seriously as we wanted him to.
Yeah.
And like the way that he interacts with fans is,
and that's the thing, I think
so
all of
beautiful.
Them, I think everyone that has been cast in the franchise seems to be very good about the fans.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the movie franchise and their fans, thumbs up.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you want to bring up? Is there anything that we forgot to mention in this like 8-hour long podcast?
This is a long episode.
Honestly, it's not as long as I thought, even. I think this is an impressive feat in filmmaking, in acting, in everything. That this came together, that we have it, that it's a good adaptation of a famous novel series. There's so much that's great here.
Yeah.
And there is so much that most book lovers get disappointed in when their thing gets adapted.
Yes.
The fact that this exists and it is good,
I was gonna say,
makes me so happy.
That the fan base is pretty unanimous on how much they enjoy the film series is a really, really good mark.
And I could pick and choose and be mad at certain things that don't appear and like the winky erasure, but this is amazing. What we got is amazing.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that we just rewatched all eight of these movies. If you're wondering, they all totally hold up, and they are very good during the holidays.
This was a really fun rewatch.
Yeah.
It was really good.
It was good. I mean, it was a bit sad, though, this time, now that we've lost a few of these actors.
Yeah.
With Alan Rickman, and then Vernon Dursley.
Oh, Richard Griffiths?
Yeah. There were a couple actors that you're just like, oh, it hits a little harder now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. But it's good.
It's good.
We love Harry Potter.
We love Harry Potter, and we love talking about movies and TV shows like this. And we really love and appreciate that all of you out there are actually listening to it. And so if you're at the end of this podcast, thank you so much for giving us a couple hours out of your day.
Yeah.
Like, whether you're folding laundry or going for a walk or driving around, like, it means a lot to us. You want to listen to our words and be a part of this community, too.
Yeah.
So We hope you're having a really good holiday season. And if you're not, put on your favorite show. Get that nostalgia kick.
Put on a bit of Fry and Laurie.
Was that your number one?
It's one of my favorites. That's one of my comfort shows. That's a good one. Yeah, well, are you ready to guess your British word?
Let's do it.
Okay, so every podcast episode, I have you guess a British word and see if you come anywhere close to the true meaning of the word. Mm-hmm. So, the word this time.
This time?
Okay, the word is hogmanay.
Hogmanay.
Yes.
Did you choose it because it sounds like Hogwarts or Hogsmeade?
No.
Hogmanay.
Hogmanay.
Now, I think probably this is like an old English word, or it comes from an old English, where, you know, it's like almost a portmanteau somehow of like words that have been smashed together. Mm-hmm. So like hogmanay, like, I don't know exactly how it got to this point, translating down the line, but it's like, if you're asking somebody like, how many of that type of livestock do you have? Just like hogmanay. Like, it sounds like you're saying hogs, like how many hogs, but it really, like, farmers use it for all of them. They get it. Like, if you're saying that about cattle, like, I know that you know that those aren't hogs, but hogmanay. And then you're like, oh, yeah, yeah, 14 hogmanay.
So if someone says hogmanay, you answer with a number?
You tell them how many you have. If you don't have any, then you don't tell them, like, a number that you don't have.
Interesting.
But, yeah. It's like, it's a question.
Interesting. Incorrect.
It's northern. You wouldn't know.
Incorrect. So hogmanay, according to the internet, is actually a Scottish word, which I thought worked, because isn't Hogwarts in Scotland?
I mean, muggles don't know.
Okay.
I mean, they film, yeah, where they film the train going through is Scotland.
Okay. But I thought you had told me once Hogwarts was in Scotland, not England.
That may be true. I don't think it's in England. I think, well, it's probably in Scotland.
Hogmanay is essentially Scottish New Year's celebration.
Oh!
Hogmanay is the name for the last day of the year. So.
Ah.
Yeah.
Hogmanay.
Hogmanay Day.
Hogmanay Day.
Yes. Perfect.
So, on that day, you want to ask a farmer how many hogs he has and wish him a Happy New Year. Same word.
I love it. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening and sticking with us. This was a long episode. We hope you enjoyed it. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. We are Anglophiles Podcast, files with an F. Yeah, and listen and see what we have coming up next. And remember, keep calm and...
happiness can be found in the darkest of times, if one only remembers to turn on the light.